to Nora.
Thank you, and just thank Roy for the invitation. I'm going to be talking basically about modern studies and theories, but in relationship to a particular project that I did. Because I'm here as a kind of relic. As some of you know, I had been engaged in a comparative project on Christianization in Central Europe and Scandinavia. And so what I'm going to be doing here is to look at how useful or useless we found modern scientific approaches, social scientific approaches to conversion. And our project was interdisciplinary, uniting historians, archaeologists, and art historians. And we looked at a very particular angle of Christianization, the intertwined processes of conversion to Christianity and the development of monarchical power in Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Bohemia, Hungary, Poland, and Rus. The results were published in a book, Christianization and the Rise of Christian Monarchy, and there's also a kind of website with supplementary material. All this information is on your handout, as is all the other bibliographical information that I will be mentioning. And because I saw in the delegate pack that everybody gets 20% off Cambridge University Press books, if you want to buy the book, today is the day. The scope of our analysis was determined, of course, by the medieval source material. Yet one can ask many different questions from the same sources, and that is where sociology, anthropology, and the behavioral sciences may be useful, but may also be useless or misleading. In influencing the way we ask the questions, in shaping the kinds of questions we ask, and in making us reflect on the material from different perspectives. Sociological studies have long engaged with understanding the process of religious change from Max Weber and Emil Durkheim onwards, and cultural anthropologists as well as psychologists have now studied conversion for a very, very long time. So there is a veritable mountain of literature out there, and I'm not even trying to give a comprehensive overview. I am just kind of reflecting on particular examples that we used or sort of discarded. Now, some of this work by social and behavioral scientists, no matter how excellent, proved to be quite useless for us, and I would venture for many medievalists, more generally speaking. Those who analyzed modern individual conversions, and the examples in your handout are Kilburn and Richardson, Snow and Mahalak and Rambo 99, had access to material that gave them psychological insights and a very detailed knowledge of the circumstances in which individuals convert, first-hand accounts of individual experiences. We didn't have any material even remotely comparable to that. And of course, as medievalists, we know that even in other circumstances, when we do have detailed narratives, such as the autobiographical account of Hermann Juda, convert from Judaism to Christianity, and this is the Jean-Claude Schmitt book, just as an example in the handout. There is an English translation of that now, but actually I'm not sure when it was published. It is well known that we need to be extremely careful not to accept at face value such medieval narratives. They rely very heavily on the Augustinian model and on a variety of other topoi. Now, another example of an in itself excellent analytical framework, which proved useless for us, is the investigation concerning the significance of social and family networks. The sociologist Rodney Stark applied this type of analysis to the study of the rise of Christianity, that is, conversion in late antique Rome, and that is the Stark, the Rise of Christianity book on your handout. Again, this is a plausible component of Christianization in medieval Central Europe and Scandinavia. Yet, however much one would like to trace these influences, our material simply did not lend itself to such an analysis. And, of course, this is one of those cases where we are confronted by the frustrating limitations of medieval sources. Another similar example has to do with early contacts between pagans and Christians. Many anthropologists were able to study the process of first contacts between various native groups and Christianity and closely analyze the processes that took place. Frustratingly, in our case, we were more or less reduced to guesswork about first contacts in many instances, and even if we had a somewhat firmer grasp on the matter, we did not have the sort of detailed material that would allow such a close reading. Now, we also encountered the opposite scenario, That is, where even though social science approaches overlap with the historical ones, in the end, they do not really contribute to historical analysis. An example of this would be the attention to social context in anthropological studies of mass conversion in the Boxer Grazer edited volume, Anthropology of Religious Conversion. That there is a rich contextual matrix of conversion beyond the immediate family may be news to psychologists, as the afterword of that book claims, but it is certainly not news to historians who naturally consider the context. Now, of course, one may then draw parallels or contrasts between the social context of one's own period and those analyzed by anthropologists. In some cases, we reached similar conclusions on the basis of our material as sociologists or anthropologists had on the basis of theirs. That is, reading modern studies did not really change anything in our approach, but it was interesting to find out that our phenomena were similar to those from other societies and other contexts. One example of this is the later reuse and even elaboration of the pagan past. That is, in our case, in Scandinavia, pagan stories were not simply kept alive, but reused and actively elaborated by Christian writers. It has been suggested, for example, that a pagan pantheon of gods was systematized by Christian authors in a way in which they had not existed in pre-Christian times. It was then interesting to find the concept of retroversion. After a generation or two of Christianization, the people sometimes reevaluated elements of their culture that had been suppressed. This is a quotation from Rambo's Understanding Religious Conversion. Other work, Sociohistorical Studies on the Process of Christianization of Whole Societies, offered some useful insights. For example, as a medievalist, I was quite used to encountering this approach that presupposed explicitly or implicitly that Christianity gained adherence relatively easily, that it had an innate superiority compared to so-called paganism, both as a set of beliefs and as an instrument of social organization. Pagan societies, therefore, were bound to fail. No wonder that all the Baltic Slavs were subjugated since they persisted in being pagans. As a medievalist, I also knew that this approach was not quite right. For example, on the one hand, Obodrite and other Western Slav rulers converted to Christianity without converting their people. On the other hand, most notably in Lithuania, pre-Christian religion was developed and used to buttress ducal power. Yet, it was quite an eye-opener to find that all things being equal, the normal reaction to mission is resistance. In your handout, this is the Rambo 93, pages 35, 6, and 87 particularly. We need to explain not so much why people resisted evangelization, though of course analyzing resistance in particular its particular causes and forms is an interesting topic of analysis, I'm not trying to discount that, but rather why they were willing to adopt a new religion. In other words, what many have taken for granted should be the main focus of questioning and analysis. And here I would go one step further as well. Through this reading, it became quite clear to me that we should distinguish between different phases of conversion's so-called benefits. It is often assumed or said that medieval rulers converted for a variety of benefits. These include, for example, international recognition due to a Christian but not to a pagan ruler, ecclesiastical confirmation of royal power, which gave rulers a more stable legitimacy, and the gaining of trained personnel, ecclesiastics, who introduced writing, taxation, and various other useful skills. In contrast, social and behavioral sciences discuss the cumulative long-term consequences of conversion. And again, there's a reference to Rambo on your handout. The relevant questions from here were how many aspects of life are affected by conversion, how extensive are the changes that conversion brings, and the constatation that when evaluating degree of change, one must look beyond the immediate results. There is therefore a clear distinction between between initial conversion and ongoing conversion. Long-term consequences are not the same as immediate consequences. Although all these were written with a view of analyzing individual conversion, it was possible to translate this approach usefully for our investigations. So we concluded that we needed to distinguish between motives to introduce Christianity and the later role that Christianity had in royal monarchy in these areas. And when one starts to pay attention to the facts in light of this division, the holes in the first line of analysis that groups together all gains as motivations for conversion become immediately obvious. How would one explain, for example, the case of Bohemian rulers? They converted to Christianity, but they were mostly dukes, not kings, so that they did not get this benefit of being a Christian king. How would the introduction of coronation, a main ecclesiastical contribution to royal power, fit into that framework when it occurred very late in Scandinavia? King Magnus Erlingsson of Norway was the first in 1163 or 64, and coronation was only introduced in Sweden in 1210. So how would this have motivated conversion around the year 1000? Or how would one account for the priority of the existence of strong centralizing power, that is, the creation of monarchical power, not with the help of, but before Christianization? And I'm thinking of Vladimir of Rus and Mieszko I of Poland. Therefore, it is rather misleading to argue that all these rulers must have converted because they hoped to receive, as one package, so to speak, everything from buttressing their power through ecclesiastical rituals to gaining trained personnel to do their administration and so on. I would also suggest that anthropological work that analyzes the phases and the consequences of conversion for whole societies over a long period, that is, long-term recurring field work like glaciers on Trinidad, can be useful to remind us that Christianization is a process with the nature and meaning of Christianity changing over time. And this brings me to the question, what is meant by conversion? It is crucial not to impose our own meaning or own understanding on what conversion should be, or to dismiss as somehow inferior the kind of conversion that does not fit our ideas. The social sciences can help here too. One example is the role of military victory and defeat as an impulse to religious change. Medievalists have long known that military defeat often led to the conversion of the defeated to the victor's religion. Now, this, of course, could be taken as purely a matter of military might and forced conversion. After being defeated, such groups had no choice, as the new religion was imposed on them by the victor. Yet an alternative explanation links defeat to voluntary conversion. Anthropological studies of Samoan and American group conversions demonstrated that local populations could understand defeat as a sign of the superiority of the new god or gods, and therefore convert voluntarily. And the reference on your handout is to Kraft 92. Medieval historians came to such a conclusion because some medieval texts, of course, suggest exactly the same thing, such as Rimbert's Life of Ansgar. But confirmation from the social sciences strengthens the case for this approach. I have also found sociological approaches helpful, even if not directly applicable to our material, in order to neutralize our terminology and thinking. The main example here is the question of fake versus sincere conversion. Since early Christian missionaries were also early writers on the process of conversion, the literature is imbued with a distinction between the two types of conversion. Knock, the early 20th century, introduced the idea of adhesion versus full conversion, so that people first were not really Christian, they just sort of adhered to the new religion, and then later on they kind of sincerely converted. Variations on the theme include queries about whether medieval people converted in order to gain some benefit, such as the wealth or prestige they saw at their Christian neighbors, or immediate rewards, such as favorable trade treaties or gifts upon baptism, or whether they became convinced of the truth of Christianity and experienced a real inner conversion. Now, I admit that, not being a Christian missionary, I find this approach particularly unappealing and indeed an obstacle to historical understanding. I was particularly pleased then to find that sociologists, based on detailed interviews and the analysis of masses of data on individual conversions, have concluded that the process of conversion is not completed with the convert joining the membership of the given religion or acknowledging a deep personal transformation. Changes occur over the long term after joining a new congregation. Moreover, the expression of personal transformation or the lack of this expression is not linked to sincerity, and this quotation is on your handout, I quote, many of the apparent conversions that take place in Protestant revivals, such as the Billy Graham Crusades, are ritual experiences repeated numerous times by the same individuals. In contrast to Catholicism and the liberal Protestant denominations, evangelical Christianity places great stress on experiences of transformation. Of course, here when they talk about Catholicism and Protestantism, this is sort of 20th century America. The effect is that equally religious people in different traditions use quite different language to describe their religiousness, some describing conversion experiences and others not. A substantial portion of the time when the word conversion is used, no real change of heart or behavior has actually occurred. Naturally, this sociological knowledge is not directly applicable, or if you like, translatable to medieval evidence, since we cannot conduct similar investigations based on interviews. Nonetheless, for me, it was useful as it criticizes the very notion of sincere conversion conceived in missionary terms. Sociological evidence indicates that radical personal transformations are rare. Rather, if a society or group emphasizes the importance of a swift and decisive conversion experience, then this will be embraced by the converts and expressed by them, so their conversion will be expressed in these terms. And in other contexts, it will not be. But in actual fact, changes associated to conversion happen during a long-term process. So these events that may appear more or less sincere are in fact rooted in social and group conventions, and conversion has nothing to do with sincerity. Similarly, knowledge of the parallel existence of strain versus social influence theory of conversion in sociology can be instructive, and this is the Stark-Bainbridge theory of religion on your handout. That is, according to the strain theory, people turn to religion because of relative deprivation. That is, conversion characterizes the poor and oppressed or those who have some great unfulfilled need. Social influence theory holds that people need to be in strong social relationships with members of a group, here a sect or a church or religious organization, in order to be influenced by them and thus convert. Sociologists then also started combining these two analyses. Now, the theories themselves were not applicable in our case, and in fact, because of a lack of relevant data, we actually cannot know what this sort of average pagan at the time of the conversion to Christianity felt, say, in Central Europe, and therefore why they converted. But I still thought that it was useful to know about this in one sense. The fact that different, indeed conflicting, sociological theories can thrive and have their adherents highlight that we should be looking for a combination of factors and not one theoretical framework. So far, I've outlined areas where either social and behavioral sciences were quite useless for our project and or other instances where we gained from a knowledge of such studies. Finally, I want to turn to the gray areas, that is, where the knowledge of work on conversion in the social and behavioral sciences can be beneficial but can also do harm. One such area is the temptation to substitute the massive modern evidence for the very lacunary medieval one, to assume that what is true of modern approaches must also have been true of medieval ones. The difficulty here is that the modern sociological and anthropological studies do indeed match some of the medieval evidence, while being entirely misleading for others. Now, a good example of this would be the topic of missionary strategies, where social and behavioral science have shown that in a modern context, these are adapted to local social and religious conditions. And the reference is to the Rambo 93, chapters 5, 6. Now, it may be true that medieval missionaries had to adapt their strategies to please a local audience. And in fact, there are wonderful detailed examples of major early modern adaptations as well. For example, this is my favorite, so it was not in our project, but I have to mention it. Catholic missionaries in China had to avoid showing or mentioning the crucified Christ, as it was completely incompatible with Chinese approaches to religion while trying to convert them to Christianity. But we should carefully distinguish between different medieval contexts, and then it is evident that this conclusion about missionary strategies does not fit all medieval situations, even if it does work in some of them. For example, we need to distinguish between, first, missionaries who in fact were seeking martyrdom more than conversion. Second, missionaries working in a mission field where they had powerful secular backing. And third, missionaries who indeed had to convince the population to convert. In the first case, in our studies, there's St. Wojciech Adalbert and other missionaries to the Prussians, and in later cases, of course, many Franciscan missionaries. If anything, these missionaries, who were really kind of seeking martyrdom, were more provocative rather than sort of trying to adapt to local circumstances. In the second case, heavy-handed methods could be used, so where there was powerful secular backing. This included the destruction of pre-Christian holy places and, in extreme situations, offering the choice between conversion and death, as in the Wendish Crusade. Only the third type of medieval context matches the modern situation on which social scientists base their conclusion, that is, this kind of adaptation and convincing people. Another example of such a gray area would be the use of conclusions by anthropologists linking the peaceful, consensual adoption of a religion with the consequent molding of that new religion to local circumstances to the stability of the new religion, and on the contrary, tying the imposition of a religion to its instability and conflict. And there's the Tippett reference in your handout. This, of course, sounds eminently logical, but we are confronted by the problem of simply not knowing, in some cases, whether consensus or strong royal power or the lack of the possibility for organized rebellion was behind the apparently smooth transition to the new religion in the Middle Ages in those areas where we have no evidence of pagan revolts. So I think in these gray areas we have to be very careful, because using the same social scientific evidence can really be helpful, or on the contrary, it can lead us into serious errors. In conclusion, I don't think it is possible to draw any overall lesson on the usefulness of modern theory and the use of the results of studies in the social and behavioral sciences. Modern theories and social sciences provide a set of tools. We need to reflect on how we use them. Louis Rambaud has praised the theoretical flexibility of recent anthropological work on conversion. I quote, "Anthropologists, it appears, do not rush to impose rigid theoretical interpretations on their data. They seem to accept the complexity of conversion events. We should follow suit." Thank you.